Welcome to this podcast by the Research Institute of Industrial Economics in Stockholm, Sweden. My name is Elisabeth Precht, and with me here in the studio is Professor Philippe Aguillon from Collège de France in Paris. Professor Aguillon, welcome to Stockholm and Sweden.
Good morning.
Good morning. Yesterday here in Stockholm, you received the Global Award for Entrepreneurship Research, the leading international award in entrepreneurship research, with a prize sum of €100,000. What was your first thought when you got the message that you had been awarded the prize?
First, I wanted to know if it was when I received the phone call. I wanted to know if it was serious or. But okay. Usually, when there are jokes, they are not at that period. It was a wonderful surprise, I did not expect. I was at a dinner in Paris, and I received that call at dinner time, and I was, of course, totally unexpected. And I was very happy. Good surprise.
Good enough. Your research focuses on the economics of growth. How does this play into entrepreneurship? And how would you define entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I think my approach to economic growth is very much, I call it Schumpeter. People call it Schumpeterian because it's very much of the view that it's growth driven by firms, driven by entrepreneurs, that the growth is driven by entrepreneurs' decision to innovate or not innovate, and to make all kind of innovative investment, research development, training, buy new equipment, and those decisions to go into new lines, to go into new ways of organizing things. And this view is, and so that's important because you look at growth from the point of view of entrepreneurs and firms. So you look at the business climate, you look at the policies or institutions that may favor or discourage innovation, and therefore the impact of growth that they can have through the incentives effect, positive or negative incentives they can produce on entrepreneurs.
Is growth without entrepreneurs possible?
Well, you had growth, you can have growth just by capital accumulation, you can have growth by imitation. But even to imitate, you need entrepreneurs. To adapt technologies to your country or to your context, you need entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. I know there's been countries that had growth planned economies, for example, had growth very much based on accumulation. And the Soviet Union was that. I mean, there was one domain where they would innovate and only one, which was defense, because they were facing competition with the U.S. But the other domain, no big innovation has ever come from there, except in defense or defense-related. Mm-hmm. So I think to turn inventions into innovations, entrepreneurship is crucial. Mm-hmm. We know that because all the big innovations have happened in countries where you have entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm. And still, entrepreneurship is not included in growth theories.
It was not until we worked on it. It was marginal. Classical growth theory would be what we call the solo model, or you would have one equation telling you how you produce final output with capital and labor. And the second equation would tell you how you accumulate capital as a result of savings, and that investment would be the difference between savings and depreciation. And that was the model. It was a very elegant model, but it's a model where firms are just production functions and they are all the same. And so all what I was talking about, how the environment impacts on incentives to produce technical progress, it's not there. And besides, the solo model, the point was to show that without technical progress, you cannot have long-run growth because capital accumulation, you run out of steam. At some moment, you accumulate capital less fast than you depreciate capital. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you need technical progress to grow. But the problem is that he could not tell you where technical progress was coming from. Mm-hmm. So you needed a different model that endogenizes technical progress and makes the rate of technical progress an endogenous function of policies, environment that determine the incentives to innovate. That was the key thing. And the other thing also is the creative destruction, which is very important, which tells you that the new and the old always conflict. I mean, you become an entrepreneur, you have rents, but you can use these rents to prevent future entrepreneurs to come. And so you have this kind of contradiction at the heart of the growth process. And that's very interesting, because you can talk about political economy of growth. You see, and that was no such thing before.
Before
you can see some societies, you know, make incumbents all powerful, and then innovation is stopped. Or all other countries have constitutions or rules that make incumbent not too powerful, and therefore you can still have new innovations. And that gets into the politics or the link between the political constitution and growth.
Yes. Yeah. You mentioned Soviet Union and planned economies.
Yeah.
How important is competition for growth, and how does competition influence entrepreneurial activities in the economy?
But you know, it's very important, because entrepreneurs, you see, competition, there is clearly this idea that when you are, especially when you are good enough, competition forces you to innovate, to do better. So there is this idea that you escape competition by innovating. I think there is this effect which is very strong. And of course, that's important when you are close to what I call the technological frontier. You know that because you know you can win. And when you are behind, more competition can have a discouragement effect. And so it took us a while to realize that competition could have these counteracting effects and to test those on data. Mm-hmm. Initially, the very early model that I worked on had the simple prediction that competition was bad for growth, because competition would reduce the rents to successful innovation. It's because we are assuming, in fact, that only outsiders innovate, never firms that are already active and making profits. And so that's why we had to change to enrich the model. And it's through a dialogue between empirics and theory that we enrich the model, and then we could come up with a richer set of predictions. That's where I really understood that, you know, really to the growth theory, you need to dialogue with the empiricist. That's very important. Yes. Otherwise, you don't have the discipline.
In your press lecture yesterday, you spoke about the importance of an excellent education.
Yeah.
What is the role of higher education that you see to make entrepreneurship and innovations thrive?
It's not randomly that you have Silicon Valley next to Stanford, or that you have the Route 128 close to Harvard and MIT. I mean, you need to have scientists, and you need the cross-fertilization between scientists and entrepreneurs. I think that's very important. And to let, you know, to have firms that are really at the interface between research and development. So it's important to have for example, the Bayh-Dole Act in the US that made it possible for a researcher funded through federal funding to patent his or her own innovation in universities and get run. That was a boost to innovation. It's very important, you know, whenever you have countries that they want to become frontier innovators, but if you don't have freedom and openness in research, you cannot really be the big innovator. You will necessarily arrive too late on the line. You see, research and development, it's a multi-stage line. You start with a kind of very basic idea, you experiment the idea, and you make it go to another stage and another stage until you commercialize the idea. Mm-hmm. And typically, the earlier steps are best performed under freedom and openness, like the university gives, you see. But there are also some firms that let their people, some of the days of the week, do freely their research. And then, of course, when you get closer to the commercialization, you need to be more focused, more proprietary, and you need both, in a sense. You see, it's important to have the interface between. So you have a number of firms that commercialize, but they want to be in contact with universities or with the companies doing more fundamental research. I think this closeness is very important. And, of course, we have incubators that put researchers in contact with industrialists and entrepreneurs. I mean, that ecosystem is very important to make any big innovation. You see, Google, I think, came from Stanford. Facebook came from Harvard. You know, it's not at random that the big innovations are being people who have been in contact with top universities.
You mentioned the U.S., and you've also worked quite some time in the U.S.
Yeah.
If you compare U.S. and Europe in this respect, Is there, can we learn from each other?
Yeah, I think you know, it's true that we don't have, Europe has very few top universities, like top or top 25. You know, you have this Shanghai ranking or the Times ranking. It's a bit, you know, those indicators are a bit hybrid because they mix up, you know, do you have Nobel Prize among your faculty or alumni, or do you have an publication index and publication impact? So it's, but those are, but you know, more or less these indexes are equivalent, and you can rank universities, and you see that most of them are in the US actually. So Europe has very few, and Sweden, for example, start doing well in the top 100, but you already in the top 50, you don't have that many universities, but you are good in the top 100 already. Whereas France, for example, doesn't appear until the top 200 of barely. So that's the advantage of the American universities. They have created a number of universities that are really in the top, quite. They are extremely good at, you know, training students, attracting good faculty, having this kind of Humboldtian relationship between students and faculty and students between themselves. That, I think, is very, they do that extremely in the best places there. It's just unparalleled. An advantage of the European universities, in Sweden you have good universities, and one advantage is that you don't pay for them. It's free education. I think that there is a big advantage, because in the US, the big problem is that tuitions have become unaffordable. And that's a huge problem. And that has contributed a lot to the increase in inequality in the US over the past 30 years, as explained by Goldin and Katz from Harvard University. Mm-hmm.
Another issue that you find very important for entrepreneurship is patents.
Yes.
Could you please tell us a bit about your view on patents and entrepreneurship?
Yeah.
And growth?
Yeah. Patents is, you know, that's an institution, patents, which protect property rights on innovation, but at the same time requires that you disclose the content of your innovation. Because the idea being that you should enjoy monopoly rights, but at the same time, you should make accessible the research, the knowledge that you have acquired. You know? And so that other people could work on the basis of your knowledge and build on your giant shoulders, as we say. And the patent is supposed to have those two things. I mean, the protection of property right and the disclosure. And it's that combination that patents have. Some people have criticized patents, say, you know, the problem with patents is that they create excessive property rights, and that slows down the diffusion of knowledge. And so I have colleagues, Baldwin and Levine, for example, have written a book saying that patents are a bad thing altogether. So I'm more nuanced. I believe that there are domains for which it's not good to patent. I was mentioning before basic research. Basic research requires openness and freedom. And openness, obviously patents, restrict openness. Okay, so I think there are stages in research which are not optimally patented. But you know, it's a fact that patents play a role. I mean, it's not the only one. There are a lot of innovations that are not patented. For example, in finance, a lot of financial innovations are not patented because they are too fast, you are imitated too quickly. So patent would not be of great help. It's just being the first that counts. But there are other areas where patents are useful. And also, it's important to have segments, as I said, even proprietary segments of a research line. They may need, IBM would need Linux, you see what I mean? And so it was good to have a segment that was open to then help IBM develop its products. You see, they had a culture of being partly open through Linux and partly proprietary. Whereas Microsoft has more a culture of being really fully proprietary. And so it's interesting to have these two cultures. So my view on patents is that there are areas where they are not optimal, and there are areas where they seem to be helpful and they survive. At least for researchers, it's very helpful because we get a metric. You see, we can look at the number of patents. We have quality index because we know about patent citation, and we see if a patent is very much cited or not very much cited. We can see also if the patent is cited by many areas, so we call that generality of a patent. We have also way of to measure the originality of a patent. Are you know, cited for the first time by other people or in areas that are new? And that's extremely helpful if we want to analyze the impact of various policies on innovation, not just on the quantity of patents, but the quality of patents measured in different ways. Mm-hmm. And patents, you know, and the citations on patents give you a fantastic metric on which you see to do research in this on innovation and policies.
In your view, does the patent system today work?
It does. I mean, it's not perfect, but it does. And in fact, I've done some studies showing that competition policy and patent protection are complementary. In fact, people thought they were opposite. So because the simplistic view was that competition would reduce rents and patents would increase rents. And so if you need one, you don't need the other. But in fact, remember my escape competition effect. Suppose I am competing with you and I can escape through innovating. But patent would help me because competition would reduce my rent if I don't innovate particularly, whereas patent protection would increase my rent if I innovate. Both go in the direction of increasing the net rent from innovating and therefore the incentive to innovate, to escape competition. So when you have the escape competition model, you can understand why, and that's exactly what you observe in practice, you have complementarity between patenting and competition policy. Mm-hmm.
In your view, how can government stimulate growth and entrepreneurial activity in the economy?
Well, there are various ways. I mean, of course, obvious ways would be to say subsidize R&D. Something more intelligent would be to say subsidize inputs to R&D. So that you make sure that the money is well used. You see, because sometimes it's R&D, but firms do other things than R&D. They may do advertising or they may do other things which is not R&D. So ways to say, why don't you subsidize inputs to R&D, particularly for small firms? So I would see several policies. I would say, for example, a Small Business Act that particularly helps small and medium-sized firms acquire, innovative inputs and to maintain that over the business cycle. I think that's clearly a growth-enhancing policy. Other policies that are important is make sure that you have a good education system. You need, when you are well endowed in education, in higher education, we were discussing before, that obviously helps, have a good research base. That's certainly something where the government can help. And also to help the labor market and product market work better, because we know innovation involves creative destruction. So you have to let the creative destruction happen. So it's to make sure there is entry, to make sure that lobbying activities are being limited and regulated so that you have free entry and competition. And also to make sure that you have a labor market which is dynamic. And to have dynamic labor market means that firms can more freely hire and lay off. But on the other hand, that you guarantee to the workers that they get trained, you see. So it's important to have the flex security system, for example, of Denmark, I think is very good because you provide flexibility on the side of firms, but also security on the side of employees, but conditional on their, recycling themselves and taking formation and looking actively for new jobs. That makes the creative destruction work better and therefore the innovation process work better. So typically, innovation-based economy, education and particularly higher education, dynamic product market because you need entry, exit, competition, and dynamic labor market because you need the creative destruction to operate well. I think those are pillars of... And on the financial side, it's good to have equity financing. I mean, if you're in a business of catching up, bank finance is enough. If you have the business of innovating at the frontier, you see the financier wants to get the upside. He wants a share of the upside and some control. So that's what venture capital can be helpful, or business angels, or private equity. That when you are more innovative, more frontier innovation, these financial modes become very important.
Mm-hmm. Can and should government pick the winner, so to say, subsidize certain selected firms or industries?
Yeah, I think that was the old way of doing industrial policy, and I think now it has to be revised. Some people went all the way saying, because we know, the industrial policy was criticized for picking winners and saying, the government will is somehow altering competition, is going against competition because they picked some firms. And also, they may not pick the right one. How do they know? They may pick their friends. So that's not good. So some people went as far as saying, because of that, you should avoid any form of what we call vertical targeting. That means you target of not targeting sectors. So you should ban sectoral state aid as a consequence. I'm more nuanced. I'm very much a competition person. I believe very much that competition is important and that if government intervene, it should be what I call horizontal targeting. Education, Small Business Act, you know, training, flex security. That's horizontal. It concerns all sectors. So I think as much as possible, a government should target horizontally. But there are instances where there are some sectors that are important, like renewable energy, health, that have their own value. You see what I mean? And so for some reason, you may want to target those sectors as well. But then you have to do it in a way which is friendly to competition. And so that's why I believe you have to combine competition with sectoral policy. Make sure that you don't help only one firm, but if you help a sector, you help everybody, including the new entrants, and that you don't privilege the incumbents at the expense of entrants. Mm-hmm. So if you have a policy like that, which is not targeted on one firm and includes entrants, it's more likely to work okay. Mm-hmm. And so I talk about the new governance of sectoral policy. I'm not as far as saying you should completely ban it, but if you do it, you should have a good governance that preserves competition and preserves exit. Mm-hmm. So co-financing with private sector would help in that respect. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Income distribution is the timely topic. How does entrepreneurship affect income distribution and social mobility?
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing. I've done some work recently where I show that innovation is positively correlated with top income inequality, because it's not surprising. Innovators, you know, Mr. Skype is very rich today. It didn't exist 20 years ago. So those who are successful innovators, they make a lot of money. And you can see that also individually. You can follow an individual entrepreneur. I'm doing that on Finnish data these days. And I can see that, you know, they are much more likely to make it to the top income if you innovate. If you have a European Patent Office innovation or US Patent Office mm-hmm. innovation. So that's a fact, I mean, and you get rents from it. So clearly that affects top income. But what's interesting with innovation and that makes it different from other sources of top income inequality is that the rents from innovation are temporary, because you are eventually imitated or there is a better innovation than you. I mean, that's creative destruction. The second thing is that we find a positive correlation between innovation and social mobility. And that's interesting. And particularly with entrant innovation, with innovation by new people who never innovated before. So that's interesting, because again, that's the creative destruction, is that when you innovate, innovation allows people who are not rich to become rich. And so that creates social mobility, and it also allows you to employ new talents, you see. And so that's interesting, is that it's a source of top income inequality which does not reduce, but in fact seems to increase social mobility. And what's also interesting is that it doesn't seem to affect more global measures, more broader measures of inequality, like the Gini or those measures, or their various indexes, the Atkinson index, Tail index, whatever, they don't seem to be affected by innovation. Whereas lobbying or entry barriers, they also generate top income inequality. But they also increase broad inequality, and they reduce social mobility. And they are not good for growth. Whereas innovation is good for growth, is good for social mobility, and does not affect broad inequality. It's true it increases the top income. So that's interesting, because you see there are several sources of top income. Innovation and non-innovation are not the same. I say that Carlos Slim and Steve Jobs are not the same people. Steve Jobs is the inventor of Apple, and Carlos Slim is a man who really made a lot of money out of having a non-regulated monopoly in telecommunication in Mexico. So that those are not the same type of individual. Maybe Carlos Slim was an innovator in his youth, but it became different. And so to deal with that, so the problem is that you see the top income inequality. Now, you might think from what I say that I don't mind about it. I think I do still, because those who are very rich can use their wealth to prevent new innovations. And then I go back to the Schumpeterian thing. So to deal with that, of course, progressive taxation is important. But I also believe in competition policy. You see, to make sure that you don't do that, put entry barriers. And I believe also in rules for, you know, to finance political campaigns. I mean, if you are in a country where money can buy politics and buy out politicians, that, I think, is a very bad sign, because, of course, you'll buy them out to put entry barriers. Whereas if you have a system where you cannot use much private money for political campaigns, you are more preserved against this type of things. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Professor Aguillon, for this interview about your research. Also, thank you to all the listeners of this podcast by the Research Institute of Industrial Economics in Stockholm, Sweden. Please visit us on the web at ifn.se.